I am your host, Antoine Medley. Join me here on the Force Pivot podcast as I, along with guests, explore how we ride this roller coaster called life, how we try to deal with the force pivots of life that we all face each and every day. No life is lived in a straight line, and learning how others deal can be therapy for us all. Listen, subscribe, and share our show with others. Let's go. Hey, good people. It's Antoine Medley, the host and founder of the Force Pivot podcast. I'm glad that you're here checking out this new episode. If you haven't done so already, please, you know, go subscribe, you know, share with your friends, go check out some of our past episodes, you know, and because I know, you know, in all those past episodes, I've had guests on and every single one of these guests that I've had have been a blessing to me, you know, just hearing their story and allowing me to share a little bit about myself with them and them sharing their stories about, you know, just how they deal with life. Because, you know, the motto of the show is no life is lived in a straight line. And I'm a firm believer in that. I know my life surely isn't. And none of my guests have proven me right, where, you know, none of their lives have been in a straight line. You know, everybody has to deal with something. Everybody has to make some difficult decisions in life sometimes of, you know, whether I go left, whether I go right, you know, and sometimes we have to take a step backwards. You know, sometimes we have to stop. Sometimes we have to pause and not move anywhere. You know, but again, you know, everybody has to make the best decision for themselves before they make the next move for themselves. And sometimes, you know, God will make us move and God will put us in places to challenge us, to make us better. You know, and we'll all, you know, hopefully if we follow that and be, you know, be deliberate in what we're doing and being obedient, you know, we'll get to where he wants us to get. You know, it may not be in a day, it may not be in a month, but I'm a firm believer that if we're obedient, we'll get to wherever he wants us to be in life. So, but again, this episode here, this is our episode 21. We are in our first season. I've told people before episode 25 will be the last episode for our season one. And then I'll figure out, you know, how soon I'm going to kick this thing back off again. I can't believe I've been doing this since, I think it was April. Yeah, I can't believe I've been doing this long. Gosh, the year's kind of gotten away from me. But, you know, the year's coming to an end, you know, and hopefully everybody will have a blessed holiday season. But right now, I've got a guest, you know, someone I'm going to bring on. I've been mentioning before in past episodes, I've been real deliberate. I've been wanting to bring on more sisters that I know, some that I don't know. Some that have been out there doing some really, really good things, and pretty much everybody that I've talked to are doing positive things. But, you know, I know behind the positive is always there's always a story there. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'm pretty sure this next guest is going to probably share some things. You know, life hasn't always been up, you know, and for her to get to where she is today, you know, there have been some challenges, I'm sure. And, you know, but I think, you know, she's going to deliver some nuggets to us that'll help somebody. And I know it'll probably help me because I grow every time I interview somebody. So, but I'm going to go ahead and bring on, you know, to our guest tonight. Her name is Vonda Page. So Ms. Page, how are you today?
Hey, Antoine, how are you?
I'm doing really, really good. I'm glad I was able to catch up with you, man. Like I said, we're you know, you're on the far West Coast. I'm on the far East Coast.
That's all right. But you know what? This world, because of technology, we are far more closer than we think. And I love the premise of your show about pivoting, because it's just so true. And the decisions that you make when faced with a circumstance really do determine if you're going to go left or right or up or down.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. I mean, I started off the show. I don't know. It just struck me one day, you know, just how in, you know, 2020, March of 2020, everything changed. Right. But, you know, I mean, everybody's life has changed since that day, since the pandemic started, you know, but we all had lives before the pandemic that right. where we had to shuffle and, you know, do our thing to get where we wanted to get even before that, you know, but I think the pandemic was just, you know, was just like such a world jolting event to make us move, you know, but you know, which we did. And I know there are plenty of stories, you know, from March 15th, you know, 13th of 2020, you know, but up to that date, you know, we all had our, you know, our other force pivots, whether something we wanted to do or whether something the world made us do. Right. So, you know, you and I, we share Virginia Tech, you know, we share Virginia Tech, you know, as an experience. So where are you from?
I am from a little town in Virginia called Gainesville. Mm-hmm. And so that's in the northern part of Virginia, about 20 miles north of Washington, D.C. That will be the next major city. And I have a lot of relatives in Washington, but grew up in Virginia in the country. I'm a country girl.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so am I. So am I. you're in the Northern Virginia, and I grew up in Southern Virginia. My home county borders North Carolina.
So you're a little countryer.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm big city country. Yeah. Country.
And I know all those areas up there where you're from are probably, you know, bigger city now than they
definitely
probably were.
I was just home for the weekend. Mm-hmm. For my 40th high school class reunion.
Okay.
And I was talking to my family. I was driving around the town and I didn't know where things were anymore, or there were, you know, huge buildings that was once just plots of land.
Right.
And you know, the interstate is encroaching more and more into the area. So that's a good thing in terms of, you know, progress and jobs and economics and all those things are good. But it just means a changing landscape and, you know, looking around for what used to be a whole lot of trees. Well, they might not be there anymore.
I know that's right. I know. I was in Washington, D.C. this past weekend myself.
Oh.
And my wife and I, my brother and my sister-in-law, we just had a quick getaway. We came up to D.C. and spent the weekend, and we were down at the harbor, we were at the casino, we were down by, I think, Anacostia, down near the stadium. All of that stuff, just, you know, everything is just so new, you know. And I remember stories I used to hear back in the day about Anacostia. It's like, man, don't go down there.
Yeah, right. You know?
Yeah,
exactly.
but yeah, but now people, you know, it's just like there are people walking dogs. It's just such a ritzy area right now. So
definitely. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it's just things really, really change, you know, and they change, you know, sometimes they change quickly. Mm-hmm. So coming from Gainesville, Virginia, I guess coming through high school there, you know, what took you to Blacksburg? You know, what took you to Virginia Tech versus many other? Most people I know that got into Virginia Tech, they got into a ton of other schools, you know, and like me, you know, it's like you kind of could have picked where you wanted to go. So what took you to Blacksburg?
You know, my high school, I went to Stonewall Jackson Senior High School, and my school had a number of graduates who went to Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. And my junior year, a classmate who was a senior, he had gone to Tech and was kind of, you know, telling me about the experience and everything. And so when I was just applying, I definitely knew that I needed to kind of stay in state just because of tuition costs. And so I applied, and then, you know, Calvin Jameson, Virginia Tech, recruited so many students from schools around Virginia, mm-hmm. specifically African-American students. Mm-hmm. And when I came down for that, they had like a weekend, I just really liked it. It's like, oh, this is cool. And the fact that, you know, Calvin James, I mean, he would call me out, Vonda Page, Stonewall Jackson High School. So when I think about it now, I realize how intentional they were about identifying students who they thought would do well at Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. And so he took an interest in knowing who we were and what we were capable of. And so that's one of the reasons why I still stay connected to Virginia Tech, although I had challenges at Tech like many other Black students in a predominantly white university. There's just those kinds of issues that were there under the surface. But there were many pivots along the way that made it, you know, possible for me to just continue to keep going. And I had always been, I always knew I wanted to be a reporter. I had my first job. I was a reporter at 15. I had a column in a local newspaper. And I had a great journalism teacher who was definitely someone who, you know, pushed me and talked about opportunities, because I'm a first generation college student. No one in my family had ever gone to college. Okay. So, you know, we just didn't know about a lot of things related to, you know, college. But I had a good teacher, and, you know, my mom is just a, you know, force of nature. Positive and saying, this is what you're going to do. No, you're going to college and we'll figure it out. We'll just do it. And because of Frances Page, who would not let me do anything, all I did was study. and my grades are good enough that I got scholarships. So, you know, I was able to afford college because Frances Page said, you will not go here, but you will go to this library.
I feel you. I mean, I know coming from my hometown, it was weird. I know the first 2 years, I graduated high school in 89. So 87, 88, a few kids, African-American kids, had gone to Virginia Tech. And then in my class, gosh, I think there might have been about 10 of us. I mean, Black students, we all went to Tech together. And then if you count the white students, it might have been 20 of us from my senior year to my class to go to Blacksburg. So it was something else. And I'm with you. I went up there for that weekend. I think it might have been during the Overton Step Show weekend. And it was just like, I mean, I loved it. I mean, because, you know, all the Black students that I saw, I mean, if, you know, if you'd have told me that it was such a small number, I wouldn't have believed it, because the room was full, you know.
until the day you went to class and walked across that drill field and you were like, oh, whoa. I don't see it. Oh, there she is.
Yeah. And it's funny how we, you know, it's like we acknowledge each other all the time. Right. Even if you didn't know the person, it's like, hey, what's up?
Right. You know, you're trying to create that sense of community, right? That sort of family to understand. And I always liken it to a little bit of, you know, not to, you know, I'll just say it. I don't want it to come off as like sort of conceited or whatever, but I kind of felt like, you know, Calvin and Glenn scoured Virginia and picked the cream of the crop. And then put us all together.
Yeah. I mean, so, what was Glenn's last name?
Glenn.
I know
when after it's over, you watch.
When you said
Glenn Valentine.
Yes. Yes. I remember Glenn. I remember, you know, he didn't come to my school, but I mean, you know, but once we got there, you know, he made his presence felt. You know, I remember him giving a speech to us about, you know, look to your right, look behind you. Somebody's not going to graduate, blah, blah, blah. I remember all that. And I don't know what I felt, but I know what you mean when you want to find some conceit. I feel like, wow, you know, I mean, I'm here, you know, right. You know, and then even being there, it's kind of like I didn't really know where I was. I was talking to a friend of mine. We went to a football game together, it wasn't last week, weekend before last, we went to the Tech Carolina game down here in Chapel Hill, and we were talking about it. We were just like, you know, we had a kind of, because when you were there, we had this little love-hate relationship, and we just like, okay, we got to get out of here. Right. But now that we've been gone, it's, you know, we've learned to take on so much more pride for the university than we may have had when we were there. Right. Because you felt like you were in here and I got to get out. But now that we're out and we're a lot more mature and we realize what we went through, and we realize, you know, Virginia Tech is really such a really, really, really good university. It's like you take on more pride than I ever thought I would when I was walking back home to my apartment because the bus had stopped running. You know, it's like, I can't wait till I get out of here, you know? But yeah, that's one. And then my hometown is so small. I had a cousin, Linda Edmonds, who was one of the first Black women in the group of the first Black women that went to Virginia Tech from my hometown. And she's my cousin. And I didn't even know that until after I graduated. I told my mom, I was like, why didn't you tell me that while I was there? I had no clue. And so now, you know, I mean, that's just another nugget of pride that I had in that school, to know that my relative is one of the first Black women there, you know?
Yes.
You know, and I keep in contact with Linda, you know, to this day, mm-hmm. you know, just, you know, because of that experience. So,
yeah, that is something that I am, you know, I feel, sorry that I didn't know as much of Virginia Tech's history as related to Black students as I know now.
Right.
I'm, you know, I was a journalism major, but a history minor, because I've always like loved history. Mm-hmm. And now the stories that I've learned over the last, even just the last year, you know, being a part of this Virginia Tech Black Alumni Society, mm-hmm. I am just so proud now and so amazed about those students and what they endured, and then how we came along to continue the next phase, and why I am, you know, really passionate about Virginia Tech doing a much better job of just recruiting and having that diverse, you know, student body, because right. It is a good university and students can get a good education from this very well-known school. Mm-hmm. And that opportunity should be available to any African-American student who, right. You know, has the grades and is able to attend. And so opening doors is just so important. We just want to open doors and thinking about my college experience now, some days whenever students ask me about, you know, what would I say, what kind of advice I would give, I always kind of say the same things. One, look beyond your own major, mm-hmm. and take advantage of everything this university has to offer. Correct. So when I think about it, I wish maybe I had looked into studying overseas.
Right.
Because that was available at Virginia Tech.
Yes.
Or as much as I did take, you know, a few classes that were outside my major, I could have taken more. Mm-hmm. I could have graduated and had more experiences beyond just what was in, you know, my wheelhouse for my degree, because that's the kind of resume you need when you're entering the workforce. One that shows like diversification.
Right.
And I will say, being a communication major has just been the foundation of every single job that I've had, the ability to write. So areas that I wasn't necessarily versed in, that I eventually entered into specific jobs, the fact that I could write saved me every single time.
Right.
So that foundational, like, I guess the same with if you're good in math and you're a good writer, I think you can write your ticket. Now, I don't know about all the other ones, but at least those two foundational things,
right.
The ability to write and the ability to add your numbers.
when I got to Tech, I was I wanted to be an engineer, but I didn't get into the engineering school. So I was in the School of Arts and Sciences, and I would have to apply to get into the engineering school. So I was taking all these classes the engineers were taking, and in doing that without my priorities straight, it was just like I was getting eaten up. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the school's fault. It was my fault. Cause you know, I wasn't, my priorities weren't set. I was, you know, like a vampire. I was up all night, sleep all day, you know, and you know, the school's so big, you know, you don't come to class. They don't care, right. You know? So it was all me, but it, you know, it took an advisor to really just, you know, it was a sister there. You know, I remember her name, you know, sister, her name was Shine, Helen Shine. She jacked me up and with one conversation, she got me on track. But question, I mean, did you have any pivotal moments at Virginia Tech that made you may not want to be there? You know, anything like that?
Not anything that made me not want to be there, but I found it to be academically far more challenging, of course, than high school. And in high school, I stood out. Mm-hmm. But in Virginia Tech, everybody's a standout. So I had to come to that realization that, yes, you're smart, but so is this person and that person. Everybody's smart here.
Right.
So kind of just get with that. And so that kind of messed with my mind for a minute because I did feel like I was not doing well. And yeah. So I had to, I think I just had to like accept that, no, that I wasn't going to be in the top 10%, but I was going to graduate and I was going to follow this path that I had. Yeah. So that kind of, you know, that sort of shift helped me because my freshman year, I went right down to the Collegiate Times and became a staff writer. By the time I graduated, I was the news editor. So I knew I wanted to work for the Associated Press as a reporter when I graduated. So my junior year, my senior year, I was pledging Delta, mm-hmm. but there was a job fair in Richmond. So I took time offline to go to Richmond, to go to this job fair. And I met this sister, Teresa Humphreys, a Black woman who worked for the Associated Press. And she told me what to do. When you mm-hmm. graduate, you do A, you do B, you do C, and you'll get at the Associated Press. And funny, it's like I graduated in 86, and like 6-7 years later, I was working for the Associated Press.
Wow.
So I've always been really resourceful. And when I sought people out and asked for their advice, I tended to take the advice. Right. What they said do, I did. Right. Except for once. So I had an internship. I was a really good copy editor. So I had an internship at the Roanoke Times, and I was a good copy editor. And they wanted to offer me a job after college, but I didn't want to be a copy editor. I wanted to be a reporter. Mm-hmm. And one of the editors there said to me, and I was still pledging to America. We see you're pledging this sorority. That's going to be a waste of time. But that one, that wasn't for him to say. I knew what he meant, but it wasn't going to distract me from doing what I was trying to do because they didn't understand anyway. But again, knowing what I wanted to do and I was going to do it, I didn't get swayed by somebody else's opinion, you know, around that. And so,
yeah, I'm going to have to get you with my daughter. My youngest daughter wants to do communications, so yeah. I need to have her talk to you.
Yes, it's a very good foundational career that, you know, and I've had challenges with it that made me not be able to do it. So I always knew I wanted to be a reporter ever since I was 15. Like I said, mm-hmm. My first paycheck was from the Potomac News.
Oh, wow.
And even after college, so there are so many comms majors that I was in class with who never worked one day in their field, and you know what their major was. Right. But 4 months after tech, I got my first job at the Petersburg Progress Index. That was my first newspaper job.
Okay.
And throughout that summer, though, I made my mom crazy because I was like, oh, I'm going to get a job. I broke out in hives. I was like hyperventilating all the time. She was like, if you don't calm down. Because I sent letters everywhere. You know, I did what people told me to do.
Right.
Clips. I went through the big newspaper. There's a newspaper index book that you go through and can research all the newspapers around the country. I sent letters everywhere. I got all these rejections. And I got some interviews, but then the one that stuck was a Progress Index. And then because Teresa Humphrey had said, so here's the path to the AP. You go to a small paper, you go to a medium-sized paper, you take the test, and you find a bureau for the AP. So I left that job 9 months later and went to Springfield, Missouri. That's another whole story. We need two.
Wait. Springfield, Missouri, from Petersburg.
Springfield, Missouri. An hour from the headquarters of the Klan. And right. I actually wrote stories about skinheads and the Klan. And once I was out on the story and I went out and the photographer said to me, Vonda, don't you ever go out here by yourself again. It's like, you know, like, but I'm, you know, I'm 25. I'm right. Hot shot reporter, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to get the story. And I didn't have any fear per se about that. I just thought, oh yeah, it's, you know, whatever. But, right. But I stayed there maybe it was a year or so. And medium-sized paper, and I really did want to, I needed to get out of Springfield, Missouri, just for the cultural reasons, and just, I couldn't find Jet Magazine, you know.
Yeah, I believe it.
It was still 1950 there, you know. So,
I believe it.
But I made some amazing friends there who I'm still friends with today, which is so cool. But then I took the test, and there were two bureaus that had openings after I, you know, took the AP test, and one was Philadelphia and one was New Jersey. And I picked Philadelphia.
Hmm. So it sounds like Miss Humphrey really did a thing with you, you know, laying it out for you and you followed it. I mean,
I followed it because she said, this is what you do. It's like, here's how it works. She said, these are rules that happen, you know, with the AP. This is what you want to do. And I think too, because I as good as a writer and a reporter that I am, being a copy editor was also very instrumental too, in terms of just having just the fundamentals of putting stories and structure together and just understanding grammar, which is like really key. I mean, I had an editor in Petersburg. He would put errors into the story. He was supposed to be fixing them. He would put mistakes into the story.
Right. Do you think that's a lost art?
I'm just so concerned about the whole world of field of journalism. I have a new subscription just because I don't want newspapers to go out of business, because it's disconcerting to me just how the business has changed and evolved, and people, you know, people don't read, and you see on social media there and there and two and two. These are not paying attention to English.
Yeah Definitely.
But when I was in Philadelphia, I worked for the AP. I loved it. And my career ended because I got carpal tunnel syndrome.
Wow.
And that was a blow. I was like, I can't, what is this? I can't believe this. This is the only thing I wanted to do my entire life. And I'm doing it. And now I can't do it because it hurts to type because my hands.
Right.
Because at the AP, it was fast and furious. I mean, we did a lot of, you know, you work fast. It's around the clock, you know, because news never stops. But it just happened. And I had to shift to,
yeah,
to, you know,
it sounds like an athlete, right? You sound like an athlete who blew his knee out and yeah. They say, okay, you can't play ball no more. So then
So then what? I felt lost for a minute. And I said, okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and stay in Philadelphia. And I said find something I can do where I don't have to type. Okay, so what job is that for a writer? Right. so I bounced around in terms of like I did some work where it was minimal. So in between that time too, so the doctors had said, I went to three doctors, they had said, listen, if you stop this kind of work, it can get better and you'll be manageable. Mm-hmm. But continuing, even having surgery, it could come back.
Was it both hands or one?
Both hands.
Okay.
So over time though, and I did have some treatment at the time, just a lot of like, actually a chiropractor was the one who really helped me because, you know, it's a nerve thing in your hand. So he was able to help me like, you know, kind of loosen up the nerves and it got better. And so I ended up working in PR. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a fast paced news business. It wasn't, you know, the constant typing, but it was just some here and there. And so I ended up in PR and worked in PR for a number of years. And then I was in Philadelphia. I'd been there 13 years. And my goal had always to live in different cities around the country. I always thought I'm going to live in major cities. I just want to, just try that. And I tended to stay 3 years and I ended up staying 13. But then I was like, the snow and ice, I'm kind of finished with that. And then perchance, Tavis Smiley, had just started this youth foundation and it came to Philadelphia and I liked what he was doing with young people around leadership. And I was like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. Cause I was looking to do like I just didn't want to do PR and I was working for utility. I just didn't want to do it. But anyway, so long story short, I said, if you ever have an opening, I'd be interested in coming to Los Angeles and working for the foundation. And then I kept in touch. And this is why I always say to people too, like when somebody says, keep in touch, you really keep in touch.
Right.
Or you get a contact and they say, look me up. Really look them up. Don't put the card in your folder and you forget it or whatever. So over 5 years, I stayed in contact with the staff. I volunteered for programs. I wrote grants. I learned all about the nonprofit world. I went and got nonprofit certification just so I have mm-hmm. a better understanding. And then 5 years later, the executive director was like, hey, Fonda, I'm leaving. Are you interested in coming to Los Angeles? I went and interviewed for the job and, you know, I left there and I knew I had the job. I went home and I packed my stuff and then because I had prepared, I was ready. I knew it, you know,
right.
Because again, I took advice and I followed it. Right. I did what they said.
Right. So, I mean, it's really, really about, you know, being prepared. Right. I mean, yeah. Because, you know, if you know, a lot of opportunities are afforded to many of us, but if you're not prepared, it's like you have to be ready. You always have to be ready. You've got to do your part.
Exactly. So I came back to Philadelphia. I started packing my stuff. That was in October of 2004. December 12th, 2004, I started. And that's so funny. I tell everybody this story. So the movers, I'll never forget their name, Beverly Hills Transport. So I was like, oh, I'm starting to come to, you know, California, Beverly Hills, right? So they come to Philly, they pick up my stuff and they're like, Miss Page, so we're going to New York to pick up a load and then we're coming back across country and we'll probably be in Los Angeles in like 2 weeks. Where are we bringing your stuff? And I said, I don't know, but I will have an address for you when you come. And 2 weeks later or so, it's around just before the holidays, I I had already shipped all my gifts to my family for Christmas and everything. I did all that stuff. I did all that packing and pre-planning. I went around places, knocked on doors, looked at apartments. The last place, this guy told me, well, we have to, you know, we think it'll be approved, but I have to let the management know, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm laughing. I was laughing at him at the time because I had already given them my deposit for the application. And so when I went down there to see him again, the second time to follow up, he hadn't even cashed the check. So I knew I had the apartment. I knew it. It was just done. I was like, okay, fine, whatever. And so December 22nd, Beverly Hills Transport called me and said, Miss Page, we're in Las Vegas. We'll be there and, you know, in the next half a day, where are we bringing yourself? Right. 9329 Isis Avenue, Los Angeles, California. You're taking my stuff.
So how was the foundation work? You know,
really, really rewarding, and I loved every minute of it. I worked at the foundation for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And again, that communication degree helped, that public relations helped, the storytelling helped, because if you're running a nonprofit, right, you're trying to make an impact. So you're telling a story and then you're trying to showcase results. And so I wrote grants, I wrote programs. This is my first foray into social media. I started our social media. They didn't have it at the time when it was just becoming, you know, Facebook was becoming popular or whatever. I learned to create websites, all these things related to writing and transferable skills. That's the term, right? So if you can write social media, what is it? Teeny tiny stories with pictures.
Right.
I'd already written longer stories with photos. That's all it is. And I knew about the fast paced nature of writing fast because I'd worked for the Associated Press.
Right.
I already knew about telling people the results of things. So when donors ask, when we give to this program, what does it impact? And I was able to tell a story because I knew about telling stories.
Right. So your pivot to, you know, they've been like this, but the good thing, they've been like this, they've been upward. Right.
Versus- I would say. And I think that if I had had the mindset that it was a loss, then I wouldn't have been able to pivot. Right. But I had the mindset that this was just a transfer.
Yeah.
That I was going to go and do something different and not be afraid to say something different. You know, because sometimes we get really sort of fearful when we lose something, we think all is lost. But as opposed to looking like, OK, so what opportunities exist out of this? Mm-hmm. So I was at the foundation for 15 years. And in 2013, it basically shut down. Mm-hmm. One, you know, Tavis as a founder wanted to do something different, go in a different direction, which often happens sometimes with people when they start nonprofits. They may not, you know, founders have a funny thing. It's like they may start it, but they're not always the people to keep something going per se. Right. Especially people who are used to starting lots of things, you know.
Right.
They're like moving on to the next thing. And so, long story short, again, because we never really had a whole, you know, whole big staff. It was always just me and volunteers. So I ended up like, okay, so you're going to have to fire me. Here's the letter to fire me. Here's the paperwork that you need. Because I'm HR too, right? So I wrote my letter. I was like, sign this letter.
That's because you're a good writer and you know what to write.
I knew what had to be done. And then, and again, so I had a choice. I was like, okay, so do I stay in LA? Because every other, you know, my family, my friends will come back east, go home to Virginia. Like, you know, I'm almost like 40 something. Well, I'm 40 plus at this time. Like, there's no like, just go home, go back home, right? Like, like I'm, you know, 12, like, go to right. So I was like, well, let me, I'm just going to just stay in LA for a minute. And the first, I mean, I was out of work for a year and a half. And the first 6 months I slept. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I had run nonstop running that foundation and just, you know, just didn't realize it when you're in it, you know, yeah. You're just working yeah. fast and furious or whatever. And at the time, so then I just said, okay, so let me just apply for jobs. Mm-hmm. And I ended up doing similar what I did when I left Philadelphia, which is in public relations and, you know, working for a city agency. So kind of like full circle back to, okay, so I know one thing, I know I can write. And it was interesting because this is a civil service position. So I'd mm-hmm. never applied for civil service. I didn't know what it was about or it entailed, because I had to take a test. I took the test. I didn't hear anything back for Antoine for months. I was like, oh, I must have failed that test. And then I just didn't realize that it is a process. So they call me and I right. find out, oh, not only did you pass, you're like in the top four people who, you know, you scored the highest.
So this is a city agency or a county
city.
Or?
City. Yeah, it's a city.
Okay.
The city department. So I go into the interview and they, you know, it's a three panel, and this is so funny. He says, we just doing small talk. And I was like, it was March 12th. And we're talking about March 12th. I said, yeah, today's Marlon Jackson's birthday. My birthday is March 15th, like, you know, right. 2 days later. So I did the interview and I knew I got the job. I called my mom on the way home. I was like, Mom, I know they're going to offer me this job. But then here's Antoine. Here's like some old back, like when you're faced with a decision, is it the one you really want? And right. I was like, oh, but I don't want to work for a utility again. It was boring. I didn't really like it. And you know, my mom, very matter of fact, Vonda, you will take this job and you will be fine. I was like, yeah, I know. You're right, Mom. I'm going to take it. And I took the job. And I was fine. So that was in 2015, I think.
So I read it in the bio you sent me, you know, some production company and some independent stuff that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So is this stuff that you're doing full time or stuff you're doing on the side?
Stuff I'm doing on the side because okay. I just have just really interest again in history and telling stories. So I started two different projects. The first Black Women project that I started is just compiling stories of Black women who were the first in something. And I thought about that in 2012 when I was watching the Olympics and I saw Gabby Douglas become the first Black gymnast to be the all-around gold medalist winner. And I just started running a list of all Black women I knew who were the first at something. And I said, let me just compile these stories. Wouldn't it make a great story? Wouldn't mm-hmm. it make a great book? Wouldn't it make, you know, something just so that we know our history and share history especially with young girls to be motivational. And I started collecting stories and I didn't do anything with it for a number of years. And then while I was working this job, I had gotten much more doing social media mm-hmm. and I had worked with a great graphic designer when I worked for the foundation. And I was like, let me hire you to create a logo for me. She created the logo. I put it up. I just started the page and I just did it. And I still have a lot more work to do because I'm working on a website for it and also trying to organize the book and an idea for a podcast for it to kind of tell the stories. So again, like I had an idea, And I just kind of sat on it for a couple of years. And it's like, well, why would you do that? Why don't you just start it? And you don't have to worry about having everything all together perfectly at once anyway.
Exactly.
Just start it. Just go ahead. Because then I kept getting so afraid. Somebody's going to come up with this. Somebody's going to do this. And if you don't have it, you're going to be mad.
Right. I came home one night from a fraternity meeting. And I sat at my computer. And I had this story in my head. And I started typing this story and next thing I know, I had a book and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I sat on that thing for about 4 years, you know, and I let people read it and they were like, Antoine, you need to get this published. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. And then, so I dove in and tried to figure out how do I self-publish? And I learned how to sell what that entailed. I learned what Amazon could do for me. I learned how to build the cover of the book and the binder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did how to go out and get my own ISBN numbers. I did all of that. And now I've got my own children's book that's published on Amazon.
See,
you know, and it's just like, you know, I sat on this thing for four or five years.
Yeah.
And I could have just went and did it.
Right.
You know. You know, it's crazy. Like, and I know I have we have a link back to Tavis in a way because my brother and I have been doing a bunch of mentoring work here in Raleigh, and the program that we had, it worked with older boys. So, and we kept getting bombarded from parents saying, hey, we need a program. Do you have a program that you can work with my five-year-old, my fifth grader? You know, we were like, okay, you know what? Let's go meet that market. So we put something together to do that. And I'm like, okay, what are we going to name this thing?
Cornell West Academy.
So I emailed brother West and up to his office, and his secretary said, I'll get it to him. And she got it to him. And 3 hours later, he said, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was just floored.
Yeah.
I was floored that was possible.
Yes. Because Cornell, people don't know that, but he is accessible. Yes. You know what I mean? He's famous and he's busy and he's still accessible in a lot of ways. So that didn't surprise me at all that he was like, oh yes.
And then my brother and I, he was like, well, come on up here. So we jumped in the car and drove to Princeton. And so we were sitting in his office. I think Mary Ann was his secretary at the time. So we're sitting in that middle part of his office waiting for him. And I could hear him in there talking to somebody. And I was just like, you know, I was so nervous. And I heard Eddie Glaude in the office next over here to the right. And he came out and introduced himself to us. And we were waiting for Brother West to come out. And when he came out and when he came out of the door and walked up to me and my brother, he went down on one knee and it freaked me out. It just blew me. it blew me away. I'm like, wait a minute here. You know, I'm like, me and my brother, we're two country boys that grew up in the double wide trailer in Southern Virginia. You know, get up. Don't do that to me. So then we presented him with something and he cried right in front of us. He was like, if my father could see this. And I was just like, oh. But he came to Raleigh twice for us to do like an events, like fundraising events. And then we took probably about 30 boys or so up to Princeton. He gave them a tour of the campus. I mean, it was just such a beautiful thing. And we kind of shut things down because, you know, I was going back to school. You know, my brotherhood was like, hey, Brother Medley, we think it's time for you to move on. So I became chapter president. I was deeply involved in this NPHC thing. And it was just, I had all the stuff on my shoulders. I was like, you know, and then our boys are sort of aged out. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to develop, okay, we need to put together a plan of when these boys get to a certain age, they can, you know, matriculate onto another program that we know and can partner with where, you know, once they move out of elementary school, they move into another program because we targeted second to fifth grade. That was our, we wanted to get them while they were little bitty little fellas. And like our first cohort of little boys, man, some of those boys that, you know, went on to the University of Chicago, they're all graduated, you know, a big majority of them have graduated college now. And it's just like, And so I've been thinking lately. I'm like, gosh, do I revamp that thing? Do I launch it again? Because I know if I launch it, it's gonna boom. Just because I know the need for working with young boys at that age group, you know. But he really proved, because I've been watching him for some time, you know, on TV, and you know, Tavis is having the things, the big covenant things. I'm watching him, you know, and you see people and you're like, are they really who they portray themselves as? And he was definitely himself and more.
Definitely.
Yeah, and more. But okay, so with your production stuff, you know, I mean, how is that going? I mean, how can people find you on some of the
work? With regard to the production company, so it's called Too Shy Entertainment, and along the way, while I was working both with the foundation and the nonprofit world, and then my current position in corporate, with regard to, you know, public relations and stuff, this production company is sort of existing in the background. The three people who formed the team. So, two friends from Chicago. They've been, you know, longtime friends, and we're wanting to, you know, just kind of be in this business for forever. And so, I met one of the members out here in Los Angeles, the director and the person who's written a lot of the screenplays. And again, the first. Going back, I hate to repeat myself, but you know, he's like, you know, you work for Tavis, you know people, you know, maybe you could help us. And I was like, no, it doesn't really work like that. People, you know, people think every celebrity knows everybody else, and that all they're waiting to do is just, they're just waiting for you to come along and help right. them with your project. that's all they're trying to do.
Yeah.
Like, no, it really doesn't work like that. So, and I said, so what? Tell me the screenplay. What do you have, you know, written? And I read it and edited it because I'm going back to communication. Like, this is a good story, but let's fix this part. Let's do this. And I kind of had an interest in screenwriting, because I'd taken classes in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. My best friend from first grade lives here in California, so she and I were friends since first grade. But she moved out here, and we had corresponded back and forth. And she's a set designer, so she's been working in Hollywood for, you know, her whole career. That's been her whole career. So she'd sent me a book on screenplay writing or whatever. So I kind of had this little interest in it. And so when I met him, I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll take a look at it. And then before you know it, we're like, okay, let's see what we could do. And it's very difficult. It's almost impossible. I wouldn't recommend anybody try to do it. Make a movie. Don't do it. Because it'll just break your heart. It's a tough business. It just really is. But I will say this though, because of, and I think the internet itself has been the great leveler, right?
Right.
Because access to information, mm-hmm. like you said, you found out how to self-publish your book.
Right. Right.
Now, before the internet, and maybe you still would have found that, but it'd been much more difficult to research. You had probably had to go to the library, but now the internet has made everything. You can YouTube anything you want to know how to do.
Anything.
YouTube University.
Right.
So with people who are trying to get into, you know, making films and movies and television, there's so many more platforms that are available. So many more ways to have your thing screened. So you may not be a block, you know, have a blockbuster film, but you can have something up on Tubi or so many platforms now. So there's that. But long story short, so we'd said we need a project to introduce ourselves, because no one is going to you know, it's this long gone are the days of you get discovered at a diner in Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard,
right? You got to have a finished product, right?
Yeah. Because no one's going to give you any money because you just have to show your skin in the game, right?
Right.
So we decided that we wanted to do this documentary, and we started in 2015 about, you know, the Woodstock of House, because both the director and the writer, they had both been familiar with the story. They both love house music. I named the company Too Shy Entertainment because two brothers from the Shy, Too Shy. And so we started in 2015. We shot it. And then it took 7 years to get it finished. And what was interesting is that we finished during the pandemic. Talk about a pivot. Because when you're doing a documentary, so it's never like a straight line. There's a story that you think you want to tell, but to be true to the documentary, you have to tell the story that's revealed in the interviews that you do.
Right.
So it took time to get the pieces of the story together and even to get people in place to do interviews because, you know, the chosen few DJs, they were all over the country. We didn't have a lot of budget to be flying everywhere and talking to people. But what happened with the pandemic? Everybody was home.
Right. Fire up the Zoom.
Nobody was going anywhere. So right. We're like, okay, we're all stuck in the house. Let's see what we can do. And I literally over Zoom. And it was so funny. The first time when we finally got the film finished and we got in our first film festival, it was amazing to see the film on a big screen because we had been looking at it on a Zoom. A little bitty screen editing on a little Zoom screen.
Wow.
And the first couple of festivals we tried, we didn't get in. And then it was crazy too because festivals were being canceled left and right because, again, we're in the pandemic, you know?
Right.
California, we locked down. We were one of the first states to lock down March. Again, I remember this. March 19th. No, it was before that. It was that week because, again, here comes my birthday again. Just like I got my other job. Right. My birthday, March 2020, California locked down, and we transitioned from, you know, going in and working from home and all those other things. And so it made me think about the pandemic and so many lessons from the pandemic. One, so I kept a journal the entire time. I've always been a journal writer. I've journals since I was, you know, since I was 10. So I have lots of journals, but I kept one and I deliberately, like day one, started with the lockdown and I went through the entire 2 years that we were locked down. And I always started with the same thing, grateful. So grateful for the things that we did have to survive this deadly disease, which could be eradicated by having water, right? Like, how crazy is that? If you washing your hands could prevent you from getting this deadly disease.
Right.
And so having water, one of the most basic things, right? So being grateful that, okay, if you have nothing else and if you have water, you're rich right now.
Okay.
You're rich. Because this is the thing that we know right now can prevent you from contracting this.
I had not thought about it that way. Yeah. Right. Because if you can stay away from people, you're good.
Right.
You know, right. And keeping your hands clean. You're fine. Exactly.
And I would often think of, I'd be grateful for, I was like, great gratitude for water, for shelter. And for food, because we had a place to stay to quarantine from the world, and we had food. And because I remember they said, you know, go and get supplies for 2 weeks and stuff, you know, which ended up being supplies for 2 years, basically. Right. And then I thought about, and then I'd say a sound mind. a sound mind, because I was often thinking of the folks who were on the street, homeless folks, who didn't have access to internet, radio, and TV, and knowing what's going on in the world, and right. and how would they manage what's going on in the world when, right. and then they don't, what don't they have access to? Water.
Shelter.
And shelter. Right. And so, you know, in Los Angeles, we do have a huge homeless population. And so the city, of course, you know, was out in force, and I would, you know, got folks masks, and we even did a drive, Deltas, we did a drive and to get supplies to people, but it just kind of boiled down to all these other things that you think you want, you think you need, you,
right.
you're, it's so important. But it, for me, it just came down to just three things. Right. And every day I wrote how I was, that's how I started my journal. It was like day one, I'm grateful for, and I would write whatever those things are. And it was always, always water, shelter, and food, because that was the basics of the survival, and then of what we knew, right? Because we didn't know.
It terrified me, because, you know, I mean there were times when this thing initially started, I was like, okay, you don't know where this thing is going to go. Mm-hmm. You don't know. I mean, you know, you think, you know, art imitates reality. So I'm thinking these movies that we've seen where pandemics break out and people go crazy and they're breaking in each other's houses. And, right. you know, all I mean, I started thinking that way. And I'm like, okay, at this point, what am I willing to do to protect my wife and my girls? Mm-hmm. Because it could go that way. I mean, mm-hmm. it wasn't far away from that, you right. know. You know.
Right. I know I found it very, I'd never seen the movie, but I watched Contagion, and I found it to be very, it was instructional, because, right. And a lot of the epidemiologists who I have since, you know, follow on Twitter and Facebook, they were consultants on that film. Mm-hmm. So there were, you know, they gave, it was real world in a sense of what the story, that storyline about, you know, mm-hmm. what would happen, because our country, you know, the Obama administration had put in place plans for the coming pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, they were already thinking ahead, and then I won't say his name, but, you know, destroyed all that. He fired everybody, the department dismantled it. But you know, they had already kind of thought this could happen. And then I read some of the stories from the first pandemic, and some of the very same things that people were refusing to do, those folks were refusing to do back then. And right. many of them, they lost their lives because they yeah. didn't want to wear a mask, and they didn't
want to wear a mask.
You know, they came out too soon before, you know.
Right.
So
right.
it's like our, you know, just human behavior around survival, and what are you willing to do to not only protect you, but then have some compassion for those around you, the right. other people, like
right.
so before we shut down, like at our offices, we had started our governor is phenomenal. I mean, their leaders in City Hall in Los Angeles were phenomenal, the health department, thinking about it now, like the things that they did early on helped, I think, for us, in at least in California, to not have as many, you know, deaths as could have happened. But before the shutdown, we in our offices, we were social distancing. We were, you know, doing all the sort of the precursor things before the full on shutdown came.
Right, and then just
having the, like I said, the willingness and the mindset to do this thing to protect you and your family. And then, like I said, what do you do in a situation where this over here is not happening for you, but what can you do? over here to make something happen. And our what can you do was to finish this movie.
Right, right. Well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of sadness came out of the pandemic, but a lot of good things as well, because yeah. it forced people to operate differently and to figure out, there was an easier way to do things than we ever thought about.
Absolutely.
And it forced us to think about it.
Totally forced us to think about it. I mean, I think about that often. And even in, when we were doing, when we were finishing up, again, we had internet access to do research.
Right.
We didn't have to go anywhere for that. We were able to kind of, just take advantage of these little screens that we had. Our expectations around this movie were, one, the first goal was to just get it finished. I mean, that's how we were. We were like, okay, we just at least wanted to have it finished. Right. To say we finished it, we finished it. And then when we got into the first festival, and they were like, what? And then two, and then three, and now 17.
Wow.
And then our first award, and now 10 awards. It's nothing but God.
well, look, how can people find your, the first black woman, so is it a Facebook page right now?
Right now it's a Facebook page. And so it's called The First Black Woman on Facebook and on Instagram and Twitter.
Okay. And how can they find your the Woodstock of House?
Same thing. So the Woodstock of House website. We have a Facebook page, a Twitter page, and Instagram, all called Woodstock of House.
Okay.
And then with regard to our film, so we are still in the festival run. So we have two more festivals, one in France and one in New York. And in New York, we're the opening film of that festival. And then once we finish those festivals, then we're going to move to hopefully having it distributed through either, theaters or one of the platforms. That will be the next step once we finish the festival run. And so hopefully it will be everywhere.
So the Woodstock House, is it, you said there's a webpage for it?
Yes, the Woodstock of House.
Thewoodstockofhouse.com?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll make sure I share that on the on the podcast page as well. But I've kept you longer than I told you I was going to keep you. So I apologize for that. But
that's all right.
But it's been a blast talking to you. And like I said, I'll stay in contact with you, because like I said, I want to get my, because both of my daughters are talking about communications, and they may be landing at the same university. So I'd love to have them talk to you about it, because I keep trying to tell them that communications is so vast, right? There's so much they can do with it, and you've done a lot with it. So I think you'd be a great person for them to talk to if you have the time.
No problem.
And they're also crazy about Delta Sigma Theta as well. So
what school are they thinking about?
They're thinking about Winston-Salem State. So. So that's my youngest. That's her number one, and I think, I think they both may land there, but we'll see. We'll see. But thank you for your time, and like I said, we'll be in contact. And I've told myself that I want to get more involved with the Virginia Tech Black Alumni Group as well. So I may be pinging you about that too.
All right, sounds good. Love to have you.
All right, I appreciate you for your time.
And, all right,
like I said, I'll let you know when I'm going to reach out to you.
Okay, good. And I hope this was helpful. I hope you got something.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, in summary, summary is just like, be prepared, follow the advice of people that you trust, move when you feel like you need to move, and, and if you can find a way to do the thing you like doing the most, I mean, what kind of life is that? That's awesome. and never give up, because
there it is.
You just have to pivot. Your love never changed, the jobs did, but your love never changed for writing. And that's
very true.
Who can ask for a better life than that?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk soon.
Okay.
Take care. See you. Bye. Bye. Hey man, look, another great episode. When you have a love for something and you can hold on to that and keep pivoting and moving and you're still doing the thing you love, man, that's powerful. You know, and I commend Vonda for doing that. You know, she never gave up her love for what she liked to do. You know, she just kept moving. And when you gain a skill that'll never go away, that'll never die, the skill of writing, that's never going to go away, ever. You know, I mean, it's funny. I hadn't thought about it, but I mean, when you're a writer, when you're a good writer, you can go and do anything. You know, because if you're a good writer, then you're a good verbalizer. You know, so what can't you do? But I hope you guys got something out of this. You know, again, episode 21. You know, season one, episode 21, and hope you got something out of it. And again, you know, for episode 22, we're going to bring on another great guest for you to hear about. You know, and I know that guest, you know, that brother is going to bring some good information. You know, just about, you know, living a life of service and, you know, pivoting and when life calls for it. So thanks for listening to the show. You know, subscribe, tell somebody, share the episode with your friends. You know, share it with 10 friends. I challenge you to do that and help the show grow. And if you ever want to reach out to me, you can. The information should be in the podcast show. Reach out to me. If you need me to come speak, you need me to come share my story, I'm willing to do that. But on the 25th episode, you know, I'm going to share some stuff, more detailed stuff about me and my journey. And hopefully it'll help somebody with their life. But I appreciate your time. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us. Follow us on all podcast platforms and social media at The Forced Pivot. Go subscribe. Share the show with everyone you know. We will be back soon with another awesome episode and guest. Remember, no life is lived in a straight line, and we must live, learn, and adapt.